today on Annenberg Radio News.
My gift to the world is that I do have language, and I can write the note or the next chapter of what life looks like.
We talked to Charles Blow of the New York Times about his new memoir. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California. Welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Thursday, October 2, 2014. I'm Priyanka Deo. It's been 2 days since Levitt Crespo shot and killed her husband, Bell Gardens Mayor Daniel Crespo. Crespo offered her side of the story today through her attorney in a news conference at City Hall. As Taylor Haney reports, he held a news conference.
Levitt Crespo's attorney, Eber Bayona, said she shot the mayor to protect her son and herself.
Looks at time may be deceiving. And you, in this case, there may be an opportunity to learn about the difficult and intolerable home life for this family.
He's talking about domestic violence, brutal enough to drive Crespo to kill her husband of 26 years. He compared the mayor to Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson, two NFL players with their own domestic abuse scandals, and called Crespo a battered wife. When asked for specifics, Bayona didn't give any immediate evidence, but he seemed confident.
I think the evidence will corroborate that she's been a victim of domestic violence for many years.
The Crespo children's attorney would not say whether the same is true of her clients. Here's Claudia Osuna.
Right now, the children stand behind their mother. They are grieving the loss of their father. But they do ask that their privacy be respected and that they be allowed to grieve.
The mayor's brother, William Crespo, lingered on the sidewalk following the conference. He couldn't believe what Bayona said.
He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just what he heard.
He said he wants proof of the allegations against his brother, and he doubts Levitt Crespo's story.
She don't want to go to jail for what she did.
Why do you think
she should have called 911?
The district attorney needs to review the evidence before deciding whether to file charges against Levitt Crespo. Taylor Haney, Annenberg Radio News.
Airport workers and supporters delivered 50,000 signatures demanding safer jobs at LAX. The petition was sent to the Board of Airport Commissioners. This has been an ongoing issue following the death of 51-year-old worker Cesar Augusto Valenzuela. The LAX worker died after he fell from a luggage vehicle. With pharmaceutical profits in the United States on an upswing, illegal counterfeits are beginning to spring up in the most unusual places. Los Angeles swap meets. Christian Brown fills us in on the latest law enforcement crackdown.
Check, check, check. Just make sure. Is this the headphones? Yeah, make sure the headphones are hooked up to the. Mm-hmm. Actually, you have your headphones. I know it's hooked up here right now.
Oh.
Yeah. Actually, not. We can leave this hooked up. Just plug it in. Give it to me.
Oh, cool.
Plug it in over here. Go on.
Check, 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 check. Was that loud enough? Check, 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 check.
Wow, we're in stereo.
All right, we apologize for that. That soundbite will come a bit later in the program. The Metro Board of Directors approved an impact fund today for mom-and-pop businesses that are being affected by the construction of the Crenshaw Line. Rebecca Gibeon reports.
Businesses in the Crenshaw Corridor are on the brink of shutting down because of the Crenshaw Line construction. Mom-and-pop shops are losing customers because of the lack of sidewalks, parking, and visibility. Many businesses have been there for years. This is why Mayor Eric Garcetti and other Metro Board directors established a pilot program that will create a fund to help businesses near the Crenshaw Line construction. First Vice Chair Mark Ridley Thomas is a supervisor who represents this area. he introduced the proposal to help the businesses.
This is a momentous opportunity for us to do what we can do to aid those small businesses who are, in fact, in dire straits.
Certainly is a way to add the most public good and create the least private harm.
That's board member Jacqueline DuPont Walker, who supported the motion.
And not a day goes by that I don't hear from a business owner or a nonprofit on the Crenshaw LAX line about the impact that our work is having on them currently.
However, some board members, such as Ara Nongerian, are worried that by helping one neighborhood, the board was ignoring other communities.
I like this. I mean, it certainly provides some equity, but we have to be equitable to the entire region for these disruptions.
The motion was passed at the end of the meeting, and the pilot program will be created. Ellen Endo thought that was a good move. She's the president of the Little Tokyo Business Association, which also represents small businesses in the Crenshaw District.
It would be at least a comfort. It would be a way to assure the business owners, the small business owners, that they don't have to close, they don't have to worry. There is an option for them.
The pilot program would fund up to 60% of potential revenue loss, as long as the businesses can show the loss comes from the construction. Rebecca Gibeon, Annenberg Radio News.
Authority.
And now we go back to Christian Brown, who fills us in on illegal counterfeits that are beginning to spring up in the most unusual places in Los Angeles.
LA City Attorney Mike Feuer had a stern word today for sellers of illegal pharmaceutical drugs at swap meets. Stop.
This practice of purchasing illegal medications, often at swap meets and neighborhood stores, harms consumers. But those who dispense these medications are violating the law.
In conjunction with LA police agencies and the Health Authority and Law Enforcement Task Force, also known as HALT, Feuer will target distributors of illegal pharmaceuticals who they say are endangering the public.
Why would anyone think that it's a good idea to buy a medication without having any knowledge of whether it contains what they want or something actually that's going to be dangerous to their health?
Brian Wong, licensed pharmacist on the HALT task force, says the drugs are often veiled as vitamins when delivered through the mail to small stores in mostly immigrant communities.
In the past, we've actually, in regards to controlled medication, seized things such as oxycodone, Valium. So those things are actually apparent, and medications as well that are not FDA approved. So they're not legal in the United States.
The city attorney's office already filed criminal charges against drug sellers this week, and Feuer says that's only the beginning. This is Christian Brown, Annenberg Radio News.
A study released today shows the risk of cancer from air pollution has been cut in half in Southern California. The South Coast Air Quality Managed District says air pollution controls have reduced toxic emissions since 2005. However, risks are still high in some areas, especially in and around the ports. But while toxic emissions are going down, a recent assessment finds cancer risk has been underestimated because of the way the state measures it. Gene Ospital is with the Environmental Health Hazard Office, which assessed the guidelines.
I will be proposing to the governing board that in the upcoming 2016 Air Quality Management Plan, that we update our air toxics control strategy.
And I have made the mistake of wearing a sweater, but it is getting hot out there. Temperatures maxed out at 95 degrees today. Tonight looks like a great evening for the Angels playoff baseball game as they take on the Kansas City Royals in Anaheim. It'll get down to the high 60s with clear skies. Tomorrow, you're looking at another hot, sunny, 95-degree day. The Los Angeles Fire Department is preparing itself for possible wildfires this weekend because of expected stronger winds and relatively low humidity. Later on, Annenberg Radio News, you'll hear my conversation with USC professor James Weiland about how his new invention is changing the way people see the world. Opponents of Proposition 1, Governor Jerry Brown's water bond that will appear on the California ballot this November, held a rally and news conference today in front of the Beverly Hills home of Stuart and Linda Resnick, agriculture tycoons who stand to benefit from the bill's passing. ARN's Jordan Plout reports.
For Brenna Norwood and other members of groups like Food and Water Watch, as well as the Southern California Watershed Alliance, the recent drought is a crucial issue that needs to be addressed with legislation aimed at helping the masses rather than corporations.
It's atrocious that in one of the worst droughts in California history, Proposition 1 would spend up to $3.6 billion funneling water and money to special corporate interests. Proposition 1 will do nothing to alleviate our drought or give real water solutions for Californians.
Proposition 1 would give the most money for new dams in state history. But Norwood says that the new dams do not necessarily mean new water, just more profit for agribusiness magnates like the Resnicks.
The Resnicks are plotting to gain even larger share of California's increasingly scarce, overtapped water supply if voters allow Proposition 1 to pass. The cost of Proposition 1 is $14.4 billion if you add all of the interest payments, and would add a huge increase in California's already massive $770 billion taxpayer debt.
Protester Elizabeth Blair is also against the bill.
This bond will not help Southern California. It won't help a lot of places in California. We need a bond that is better written, that actually helps support our infrastructure.
Food and Water Watch even provided actors to impersonate the wealthy couple and business partners because, to them, the Resnicks are symbols of big agribusiness.
Thank you for coming to our home. I'd like to propose a toast. To wealth.
To wealth. And ours just keeps growing and growing.
The actual Resnicks and other major backers of Prop 1, including the American Council of Engineering Companies, argue that the bill would provide a reliable water supply for farms and businesses during drought. Supporters of Proposition 1 have spent about $2 million to push the bond. Norwood says she hopes voters will pay attention to their message and not the money.
Real water solutions!
Not water for the 1%!
Real water solutions!
Not water for the 1%!
Jordan Plout, Annenberg Radio News.
You won't be going to the theater to see Adam Sandler's newest movie. Netflix announced today that they are partnering with the actor to produce 4 original films to premiere online in nearly 50 countries. The on-demand media provider will fully finance all 4 features, which will be developed by Sandler's Happy Madison Productions. According to USC cinema professor David Weitzner, this will be a watershed moment in movie making.
I think it's genius on the part of Netflix. I applaud them for it. They're a major player. They want to be a major player in the entertainment industry and in film. And why not do it?
Sandler joked, the only reason he agreed to the offer is because Netflix rhymes with wet chicks. USC and UCLA may be the fiercest of rivals, but today they came together for a good cause. The 2 marching bands both played at the inaugural Rivals United for a Cure. It benefits cancer centers at both schools. We have this sound portrait from the event featuring former USC and UCLA quarterbacks Paul McDonald and Matt Stevens.
Jeff Collins, I'm actually a staff member of USC with the marching band. The USC band is here in conjunction with UCLA band and athletics to raise awareness for cancer. Both schools are coming together for cancer research.
Adam Fletcher. I am a trombone player for the UCLA Bruin Marching Band. Today, here with the UCLA Bruin Marching Band, we are playing a rally for Rivals Against the Cure, to find a cure for cancer.
Matt Stevens.
I am the spokesperson for Rivals United, and I'm also the color commentator for UCLA football.
This year our goal is 500,000 net. Thus far in the previous 2 years, we've netted 600,000 combined, so we're upping the ante, trying to create greater awareness for the underfunded cancers. Paul McDonald, and I'm Matt's counterpart, representing the Trojan side, former color analyst for USC football.
We have fun too. I mean, that's UCLA. I mean, one day, I mean, we're going at it, and we are rivals, but we also want to show everybody that, yeah, two rivals can come together for a good cause, for a greater purpose.
That sound portrait was produced by Belinda Kai. The first case of Ebola in the United States was confirmed this week with reports of at least 100 people exposed to the infected patient. Despite heavy media coverage, experts say the chances of the virus reaching college campuses is close to zero. Diana Crandall spoke to a USC professor who studies the spread of viruses.
Ebola is fatal for about half the people it infects. However, it is highly unlikely to reach USC, says Paula Cannon, associate professor at the USC Keck School of Medicine.
Let's not all panic. You know, Ebola is still a relatively small outbreak and it's confined to Western Africa. And the chances of it coming to USC, you know, right now are practically zero, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't all be aware of what the risks could be and how to respond appropriately.
Despite how scary the virus may seem, Cannon says it's more important for students to focus on protecting themselves against all viruses, not just Ebola.
I would say to all any USC students listening, just make sure next time you go for a health checkup, make sure your vaccines are all up to date, because it won't just protect you, but it'll protect the rest of, you know, the population from any other viruses.
The New York Times reported Wednesday that federal officials are planning to dramatically increase the production of ZMapp, the experimental drug being used to treat Ebola. Medical experts say that supplies of that drug will only be available in the hundreds or thousands by early 2015, which will be a problem if the virus continues its turbulent spread. Diana Crandall, Annenberg Radio News.
USC has developed an eye implant to help blind people gain a little bit of eyesight back. The device is called Argus 2 and treats retinitis pigmentosa, a disorder that destroys light receptors in the eye. The device is implanted in the eye to provide light perception capabilities. The patient then wears special sunglasses outfitted with a battery-powered camera, and that sends visual signals to the eye implant. I spoke to USC professor James Weiland, who helped develop the eye. What Argus 2 is and what it does, just in a few sentences, would you be able to tell me?
Argus 2 is an electronic device which can be implanted in and around the eye of a blind person. What it does is it works with an external camera, a customized external camera, which is worn on a pair of glasses, to provide a crude sense of vision to someone who has little or no light perception capability. People who get these devices can tell whether it's a sunny day or it's dark at night, and that's about the limits of their vision. With the Argus 2, they're able to see people moving in front of them. They're able to see large objects that they can avoid, or they can use the lines of a crosswalk on a street to safely navigate a crosswalk.
Has it commercially been used?
So it's now approved for sale in the United States and in Europe, and there have been over 50 commercial sales. And the first one west of the Mississippi was done here at USC earlier this year.
Why is this a better, would you say even, that this is a better alternative than surgery?
You want to have improved vision. There's really no alternative for you. This is the only thing. The cost of the implant and implantation is $150,000, which seems like a lot of money. But understand that this is a permanent implant. So people who get this device may be in their early 50s and blind. So if we can restore some useful vision to them and provide them with some more independence, then that's a benefit they could realize over the rest of their lifetime.
Do you have any last thoughts on perhaps the importance of Argus 2?
People become very emotional when they get some vision back, the people who have had vision. And these are all people who have had some vision and then lose it. It's almost when they have nothing, and then they get a little bit of vision back. And so for many of our patients, not all, but for many of our patients, it's actually quite a momentous a change in their lives, even if it is a small amount of vision.
Argus 2 is the first step that will pave way for the future of helping blind people see again. Charles Blow is a New York Times columnist and TV commentator, and he recently published a memoir. Maya Williams sat down with him to discuss his writing process and inspiration.
In the corner of a large lecture hall filled with books in USC's Doheny Library, I sat with Charles Blow as we discussed his deeply personal memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. Given the setting, it's no wonder our conversation veered towards reading. You mentioned, I think, the first thing you ever bought was a picture book of Job, which I thought was interesting and kind of allegorical. Do you still have that book?
Oh, I do not have that book. I wish I had that book. I can remember the pictures as if it were still, I still had it. It is the idea that I would walk into a library and think, how is it possible that all these thoughts on shelves, and how can I get through as many of them as I can? My books are like comfort food. I go back to the same few books over and over, and they're not necessarily the classics. I mean, the only book that stays on my nightstand is the Encyclopedia of Black Folklore, which is a strange book, out of print. No one has it. My mom gave it to me, so I keep it by my bed.
Departing from his op-ed journalist writing style, Blow set out to chronicle the darkest moments in his life as a young boy raised poor in rural Gippsland, Louisiana. A victim of sexual abuse and harsh bullying, Blow found it important to voice the tragic moments of his past. The result is a collection of prose with pastoral imagery and lyrical descriptions. For example, he told a group of USC professors, "Masculinity is a thin beam that few can walk, and those who do can't stay on it, and when they fall, they fail and hurt themselves and others." The catalyst for his catharsis was two tragic occurrences in 2009.
Two little boys, both of whom were 11 years old, did not know each other. They both hanged themselves 10 days apart from each other. One was named Jaheim, who was in Atlanta, and Carl was in Boston. And both of them had endured relentless homophobic bullying. And I saw that and thought, you know, this can't be. It just can't be that kids feel this lonely, this hurt, this much pain, feel that suicide is the only way out. And I had been in that place. I saw it from both places. I had been in that place. I had been that kid. And I, having been that kid, I knew that feeling of isolation and oppressive weight of ostracism. And I knew that a lot of times when young kids commit suicide, they don't leave notes, so you don't even know why. And if I had committed suicide when I thought about it, when I was 8 years old, even younger than these two boys, I wouldn't have left a note. And sometimes that's because they don't have language. And I thought, my gift to the world is that I do have language. And I can basically write the note or the next chapter of what life looks like after you decide that is not the best way out. And it may not be easy, and it may not be an easy road to go, but you can make it, and you can learn to love yourself, and you can be loved by other people, and you can have a family, you can have a career, and you can have a life.
Fire Shut Up in My Bones is now available in stores. Maya Williams, Annenberg Radio News.
For the past 2 weeks, Pasadena has hosted some unusual new media, art, and music performances. The events, all part of the Axis Festival, explore the connections between art and science. Heather Heiss reports from the Carnegie Observatories.
I sat on a blanket under the stars,
listening to the music of composer and USC alum Matthew Brown. As the bell tones and percussion hits evaporated into the night sky, I thought about him composing the piece. Was it a process of following the rules, or of discovery and exploration? The violinist interrupted my reverie with an improvisatory solo. My questions were related to a talk from earlier in the evening. Two young scientists, Juna Kohlmeier and Andrew Benson, had explained some new ways of making sense of the universe. Unlike traditional astronomers, who work on interpreting pictures taken by telescopes, Juna and Andrew begin by imagining. They see in their mind's eye what they think they will discover, and then they visualize it. Brown's composition is called Hand in Hand at the Edge of the Sky. It was inspired by a hike he took near the Mount Wilson Observatory. But aside from that, the connection between the music and the talk was a bit nebulous. Still, the event made me wonder if music could borrow from the scientific method. What if making music was more about curiosity? Setting traditions aside, where might our musical imaginations take us? Heather Heiss, Annenberg Radio News.
Now it's time to hear the sounds of another place that's uniquely Los Angeles.
Sonic City! Sonic City!
I came here to the United States when I was really young. So I grew up in the United States like any other typical young, you know, person that migrates from another country. I come here, you know, whenever I have time. It's a way to relax, to connect, to enjoy, you know, a little bit of my Mexican traditions. Luckily, some of the Aztec dancers were here. This is one of the things that I come here the most. So I really enjoy that a lot.
Sonic City!
Now we check in with Patricia Silva to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision.
ESPN's Hannah Storm came to Annenberg today to talk about the future of women in journalism, what she says all aspiring reporters need to do. Another NFL player is under arrest for sexual assault. What's next for him? And more than 4,000 people received free shoes in South L.A. today. What the community had to say. Coming up on ATVN at 6.
Thanks, Patricia. The USC Trojans are seeking revenge against the Arizona State Sun Devils, and Evan Budrovich reports on the team's mindset heading into Saturday's showdown.
The number everyone's talking about at USC football practice? That'd be 62.
Hopefully it factors into our pride. Nobody likes giving up 62 points at any level.
Head coach Steve Sarkisian said, a man hired to fix that type of performance.
So hopefully that affects our pride and affects our preparation and the fact that that shouldn't happen again.
The Sun Devils come to town without their starting quarterback, but after being gashed for the most points in program history, defensive tackle Antoine Woods expects his unit to be more fundamentally sound.
Just being assignment perfect and make sure everybody just do their assignment and just, you know, just stay into it all four quarters.
A win on Saturday against the defending Pac-12 South champions would give the Trojans a much-needed boost of confidence heading into the second half of the season. In the meantime, the Trojans are pioneering a first-of-its-kind outreach program tonight, competing in an online gaming session with U.S. troops based in Afghanistan. Evan Budrovich, Annenberg Radio News.
That's it for this Thursday. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Priyanka Deo.
Thank you.